Here we go. Welcome to the inaugural episode of BP WrigleyCast, a Chicago Cubs podcast that covers news, notes, and analysis from a few of the writers behind BP Wrigleyville. Welcome to our very first episode. My name is Carlos Portocarrero, and I'm joined by Isaac Bennett, Joel Reese, and Ryan Davis. Before we get into the meat here, we're just going to go and say a little bit about ourselves. So, like I said, my name's Carlos. Been a Cubs fan since I was, 10 years old in Guatemala watching on WGN. So that's the gist of my background as a Cubs fan. And I've been writing about the Cubs for 2 or 3 years now. Isaac, you want to go next?
Sure, absolutely. I'm happy that I can pronounce your last name now that you've said it first. So I feel quite good about that. But my name is Isaac Bennett. I've been writing for Wrigleyville since it started in April. Been a Cubs fan since I was born. My father was a Cubs fan, and that's the background for me as far as where I came from. His grandfather was a Cubs fan. Beyond that, I'm a global sales director for a mining company, and I invest in real estate. That's about it.
I'll go. This is Joel Reese. I'm in Chicago. I've been a Cubs fan most of my life, although I did bring the big red machine into the equation in the mid-70s. I loved them.
We'll just edit that out. Don't worry about it.
I've been to many Cubs games. I grew up in Evanston, so I would take the red line down, although it wasn't called the red line when I first started. And I would go to games all the time. And I've been writing for BP Wrigleyville since it started. I've also written for Deadspin, Details, Spin, Chicago Magazine, Texas Monthly, and I was in the Best American Sports Writing Series.
All right. That's enough showing off.
This is Ryan Davis, and I guess I've been a Cubs fan since 1998 when I was 13, 14 years old. Got really into it with Sosa and the home run thing, and actually grew up a big Grace fan. And then, a couple years ago, I started writing for CubsInsider.com when it was on Chicago Now with Tom Loxas and Evan Altman. And now I'm with BP Wrigleyville. I also write for Today's Knuckleball on FanRag Sports. I write for the Wall Street Cheat Sheet and do just kind of general sports there. And, I think that's all I do.
So we have four guys that know their baseball, know their Cubs baseball. And we hope to make this as entertaining and informative as we can. We're excited about the season. I can't remember the Cubs being this favored ever before a season began. So either way, whatever happens along the way, we're excited to have you with us. And I think a good place to start is Baseball Prospectus released their top 101 prospects. 2 weeks ago? Cubs had a very nice showing with six players.
Six.
In the top 101. Theo Epstein said that the goal was always to have sustainable success. And after graduating so many guys from last year's list into the major leagues, seeing this many guys on this year's list is very encouraging. Anything that you guys want to focus on from the top 101 prospects?
Yeah, a couple thoughts. The first thing that really stuck out to me actually was Eddie Julio Martinez coming in at the back end of the back end of the list. 7, I think. But it was really interesting because you get through the first 5 that you kind of expected to be on there, and then you're thinking, who's the 6th going to be? It could be Jaime Candelario. It could be a couple of guys, really. And then when Eddie Julio popped on there, I was really excited because it just felt like the $3 million we spent on him was a huge bargain.
It also kind of felt like it almost felt like a test to see, who really knows all the prospects? Because this is probably one of the names, since it's such a new name that maybe some Cub fans aren't familiar with him being so far away from.
Yeah, there's no question. And it was also, I think what was most exciting about it is that I read another list that had Martinez at 19th in the Cubs system. So the divergence of opinions between where 6 and 19 can be in our system is so broad. And to me, that speaks to the depth of the system. I think the fact that you can interchange anywhere between 6 and 19 just really speaks to how deep we've become.
And I think that the kind of surprise, not surprise, I guess, that he's so high, but Gleyber Torres coming in at number 41, I didn't really think he was going to be that high, although I have high hopes for him. And, I mean, it just speaks to, I mean, he's another Cubs shortstop prospect after we've joked for several years about the Cubs just collecting all the shortstops. And, I mean, just in general, he's such a good player. And coming in at 41 at, what is he, 20?
Yeah.
That's, you know, he's very highly ranked. I thought Wilson Contreras was going to be the top Cubs prospect, and he came at number 57, so that kind of tells you a lot. But, yeah, Torres was kind of the big surprise for me, having him that highly ranked.
I was surprised to see Albert Almora drop so far. He's at 83, and the year before he was at 38. And I know we talked about him a little bit. I know that he had a great latter half of the season. I know he's had some injuries. But to me, he's – I mean, there are many of these guys are intriguing. Martinez and Torres are both obviously very intriguing. But Almora, we've heard about, and what intrigues me about him is just the way people gush about him, and they just speak so reverently about him as a player. They've got these, you know, they say he's got these leadership qualities. Like, and I've heard the comparison of Jeter-like, which is, you know, as high as you can get. So I'm very curious to see just kind of what happens with him. And along those lines, you know, you've got Matt Caesar, you've got Chris Coughlin, and now you've got Matt Merton in the picture too. So it just speaks, I guess, kind of going bigger picture. It's just interesting to see, you know, a couple years ago, all we were hearing about, you know, there was like, oh yeah, Hesop Choi, he's going to be great. Or Brett Jackson.
Why do you have to go there?
But it's so great to see that you've got all these, you know, you've got this like embarrassment of riches, whereas before it's like, well, you know, who was the guy that got impaled with the bat coming down the third baseline?
As he's laughing.
Tyler Colvin, yeah. Oh my God. Yeah, that was like, I'm sorry, I really brought us down here, didn't I?
Yeah, I was going to say, we're like 5 minutes in, and you're already talking about Tyler Colvin getting impaled.
And Hesop Choi, and let's throw out Corey Patterson while we're at it, and everybody
else. Where's my sad trombone button? On
Joel Banhammer.
I was going to say, you mentioned Matt Merton. Speaking of Matt Merton, Billy McKinney came in number 74.
Really?
Do you think that's the comp?
I do, yeah. I'm not as high on Billy McKinney as others, and I guess I'm not as low on Billy McKinney as some others. There's a really wide range of how people feel about him, but I think he's kind of a fourth outfielder. He can hit, but does he do anything else really extremely well? I don't know. I mean, is he a starting outfielder on a team as quality as the Cubs are? Once he's ready, I don't see that.
No, he reminds me of Mark Kotze for some reason.
Kotze, that's an interesting comp.
Names I didn't think would come up tonight.
Maybe it's just Kotze. The left-handedness, I'm not sure. Well, one of the things that concerns, well, maybe not concerns me, but I think is interesting about the list is no pitchers. No pitchers on the list.
Yeah. That's going to change.
And it's interesting because, you know, there's a lot of those younger guys in the lower minors that we hear a lot about. Dylan Cease and refresh my memory on the other.
Steele and Sands.
So there's a bunch of guys down there, but this list, you know, only position players, it just goes to show that, you know, the front office still believes in the strategy of kind of focusing on bats that can move quickly. And at some point, though, you know, everybody has moved very quickly, and everybody's, not everybody, but a lot of these guys are in the majors, and you got to start you got to think that you got to start acquiring some pitching at some point.
I think a couple things are happening. I think that because we haven't had any successful pitching promotions, guys are suffering from the fact that the whole system is maligned from a pitching standpoint, and they're not getting any love because of it. And on the other side of that, I think some of the hitters are getting maybe more love than they deserve because of that. I think Billy
McKinney. That's an interesting point.
Yeah, I think Billy McKinney is one of those guys. And actually, just Joel, to go back to your point about Almora, his first half last year was an absolute dumpster fire.
Right.
And people do talk about his intangibles and everything else that he brings to the game, but because of how bad his first half was, I think people are sleeping on his bat. I've seen lots of reports of
interesting.
Yeah, sounds uncomfortable.
Yeah, I think they are. I think they're sleeping on his bat. But people are comping him to Barney because of the elite glove and the maybe lacking. Whoa. I know, ouch, right?
Oh man.
But really, I think that, you know, it wasn't all that long ago Theo Epstein was saying he was the best pure hitter in the system. And when you watch Albert Almora play, the contact that he makes is so loud, and he so consistently hits line drives that I think he is a guy that can put it together and all of a sudden look like the center fielder of the future really, really quick. I expect
him
to
play,
be
correct?
A big breakout. Yeah.
And
I've seen him play a few times.
Yeah,
oh, he's a baseball player. Yeah, so good. Just a baseball player through and through. He's one of those guys that I think
Man crush.
Oh, man crush for sure.
You know,
man crush for sure. If I'm ranking the guys myself, I'm probably going to take Wilson first.
Are you ranking because, them, or are you asking them out on dates?
Both.
Oh, just checking.
Yeah, right. I'm going to take Wilson first just because of his long-term potential at catcher, which is the position of need. I'll take Torres second, but for me, after that, it's Almora, and I think he's a pretty clear-cut three. I mean, if you look at him and compare his age to Ian Happ, I don't know why everybody's in love with Happ and not Almora. I think Almora's actually proven quite a bit more than Happ has.
Well, Happ has positional versatility, which is a big thing, obviously. So I know that's something that, you know, people have talked about with him.
Or no position.
I think it is kind of insane that both Happ and McKinney both came in ahead of Almora. I don't really understand that. And anybody who comps Almora to Darwin Barney needs to be impaled. So
we have a position for Tyler Colvin in the front office, impaler.
It should be a big season for Almora this year. See if he can kind of replicate what he did in the second half last year. And he'll be starting at Triple A, I believe, right?
It's huge, and actually, I think that's why Matt Merton is brought on board, because Matt Merton is one of those guys that was wise beyond his years, and they really valued his intangibles and his leadership. I think he's the David Ross of AAA. I think he's there for Albert Almora. He's there for Ian Happ if Happ gets up there, and I think he's there for Eddie Julio Martinez when he gets there. I don't think it has anything to do with fighting for the fifth outfielder spot or anything like that.
Wow, now that's an interesting theory. I love it, but do you think Matt Merton has David Ross type leadership capabilities? I only saw him when he was in the majors. I don't know what he did in Japan. But can
you don't know what he did in Japan? You're breaking records over there, man.
Well, I mean, I know that he hit well, but I don't know what he did as far as like developing intangible leadership skills. That's what I meant.
Yeah, I don't think anybody.
I think he was like Bill Murray.
Yeah, I don't think anybody's going to know what Matt Merton, you know, as far as developing leadership skills goes. But I don't see why he couldn't. I mean, I guess he was never a problem when he was with the Cubs. He always seemed like, you know, pretty smart as he's aged that he's figured out kind of the, you know, leadership role. But to say David Ross of AAA, though, I mean, that doesn't sound like a compliment at all.
It's interesting. I mean, what other guy can you guys think of that gets signed to a minor league deal, probably will not see very much action, if any, at the big league level, causing this kind of just happy feelings all over for Cubs fans?
Well, it's funny. I remember when the Cubs got Garcia Parra, and I was – weren't you shocked – when he was like, oh, my God, and this was back, you know, again, in the Mr. Downer here, like when they got one, they had one good player, and you're like, oh, my God, look, they have, you know, Brett Jackson in 2 years might be good. But when they got Garcia Parra, I was just amazed. And I remember Bill Simmons wrote about it, and he's like, look, Garcia Parra I loved him, but his time here was done. I'm okay with him leaving, but why did we give up? And he called Merton like their top prospect or one of their top prospects. So I was like, I mean, he came over here with a pretty big, you know, some pretty good pub. And he was, you know, obviously a solid hitter, but it's interesting. So maybe using Isaac's theory, maybe this means that, Isaac, do you think that this is what they want, they foresee Almora doing, just becoming a good contact guy, and maybe that's what they hope Merton can teach him?
Possibly. I'm maybe not saying so much that the game will translate. Matt Merton was a really good hitter, and frankly, he had two very good years for the Cubs before we essentially relegated him to a bench role and then shipped him off in the Rich Harden trade, which I don't really understand why he never got more of a chance.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I don't really understand why that Merton never really got a chance anywhere else. He's not a very good fielder, but... Yeah.
Pretty bad, actually.
Yeah, but other than that, I mean, the guy can clearly hit, and he could really rake left-handers. So I don't understand why he didn't get a job in the AL or, you know, as like a fourth outfielder in the NL, you know, spot starting in left field and right field. I don't understand that. I mean, he obviously made a career out of raking in Japan, but he definitely, as long as he hasn't lost anything in the bat, he probably still has a role in the major leagues. Maybe just when, you know, if somebody or a few people get injured, he might see time with the Cubs. But I think he definitely has a spot where he's good enough.
I love that he went to Japan, because this is what happens to these kind of guys, right? Like, they hang on and they hang on and they keep waiting for their break, and then they, you know, you turn into one of these guys that's been in the minor leagues for, you know, 13, 14 years, finally gets called up, and it's just kind of as a favor to the player for, you know, hanging around for so long. Matt Merton, you know, he was around after those two good seasons for, what, one, two seasons, and then he said, forget this. I'm going to Japan. I'm getting paid. He made about $14, $15 million, and now he's back. I mean, I feel like it's a great story for a player to just say, this is a great opportunity. I am not sitting around to, you know, to wonder later on, oh, why didn't I get a chance? Why didn't anybody give me a chance? I don't care. I'm going to go make my opportunity in Japan.
Well, he probably made a lot more money there too, so.
Yeah, absolutely. And good for him, sure. Being able to do that and recognizing the opportunity. And now I think the biggest reason that it's a story, if he had come back and signed with, you know, throw out any team, the Oakland A's or the Colorado Rockies, whoever, this may have been just kind of a blur, but the fact that, you know, he was with the last, you know, kind of era of Cubs baseball, you know, spanned the Dusty Baker era and for Richard, which was kind of a benchmark deal for that era of being a Cubs fan, because it really was symbolizing them just going for it and going for it really hard in 2008. The fact that he's back with the Cubs, that means a lot to the fan base, I think. So there's a lot of people who really would like to see Matt Merton succeed.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's definitely a legacy play. The one thing I don't think people should expect is to see him in the major leagues. The last two seasons in the NPB, he wasn't very good. He was basically a sub-replacement level hitter. He OPS less than 700, which is pretty bad over there. Which is why my theory of he's coming over here for leadership to start in AAA and then maybe, you know, eventually for some sort of coaching role, hopefully with the Cubs. But I'd be very surprised to see him make the 25-man roster at any time during the season. I don't think that's why he's coming back. But I'm really excited to see it, even just for leadership for the young guys down in AAA and for the possibility that he could be with the club moving forward.
I heard they're in conversations to bring back Augie Ojeda.
Well, finally, your Augie Ojeda neck tattoo won't be irrelevant anymore.
I know. Finally, it's time to bring it back out.
Can we get Lou Montanez back again for a third run through?
I remember when he came to Wrigley the day he signed and hit BP, and it was like, A-Rod comp was there, and the Derek Jeter comp, and everybody was so excited. And he was 18 years old.
Such good times.
I wonder if the talent evaluation was that bad, or if they just didn't have the right coaches developing them, or they didn't use, you know, statistics to say, okay, here's how you can improve your game, or is it all of the above? Just kind of a half-ass organization.
We'll never know.
Yeah. It was. I think we do know part of it, and that is that it was a half-assed organization. The Cubs were just in general really, really, really terrible at talent evaluation and talent development back then. If you look at Giovanni Soto as an all-star for the Cubs, I think in 2008 in his rookie year, what was the last position? Yeah, what was the last position player they developed through their system to be an all-star before that? I want to say it was like Rafael Palmeiro. Yeah. I mean, that tells you a lot about, you know, how bad they were in general, just, you know, being able to recognize talent and develop it.
This is just depressing.
Well, that's just what's so exciting is that, you know, I mean, for someone like me who's been a fan for a long time, and I'm not doing that to brag, I'm basically saying I'm old, it's just so revelatory to see, like, this new regime do the right things, and it feels so good to see smart people in charge. And you compare that to, like, I don't want to get off topic, but like the Bulls are clearly a team with that they just don't quite make the right decisions, and it just filters down to, you know, a coach who's a little over his head and an offense that's out of sync. And whereas this, they just seem to make the right move time and time again, and it's just so incredibly exciting to see that, you know, because for most of my life they've been such an also-ran, you know, and it's like, no, here they are sitting at the big boy table.
The old guy is wandering off into Bulls territory, so I'm going to bring it back to, you know, we're talking about Matt Mertens. Let's talk about another former Cubs outfielder, Dexter Fowler, still available on the free agent market. Dexter Fowler, I was looking up some information about him, you know, since we were talking about the top 100 prospects. He was on the list in 2009, ranked number 12, ahead of Mike Stanton and Andrew McCutchen. And now he is a free agent and seemingly can't, you know, not that he can't, but he has not taken an offer, signed with a team. We got, 2 weeks left in spring training. What does everybody think about that?
It sounds like he was kind of a bust if he was ranked number 12 ahead of Stanton. I'm half joking, but I mean, it's a bit surprising that he's still out there. I don't really see why. I was writing something for a different site the other day about how he really makes a lot of sense for the White Sox, and that's kind of where, like, if everything matched up really well and the White Sox actually decided to go spend some money, that he could end up out there, and you could bump Adam Eaton, who's not a good center fielder at all, over to right field, and then move Avi Garcia to the bench. You could improve the offense and the defense in Chicago on the south side.
I'm not familiar with this White Sox of what you speak.
Yeah, sorry, I took a turn.
I don't know them.
That's where I feel like he makes a lot of sense, but there's just nothing that's developed really seriously on him at all.
It is strange, isn't it? I can't figure it out. And I don't know if you guys have heard periodically, I've heard I think that there have been some writers who've periodically said, well, maybe the Cubs are still in play. I don't get that at all.
No, I don't agree with it at all. I don't think there's any chance. I actually said back at the beginning, and I wish I'd written a piece to this because I said it, but I didn't actually document it. I thought Dexter Fowler should have taken the qualifying offer. I thought this was a horrible year for him to try and test free agency. He was a guy, you know, he's a 1.5 to 2.5 WAR player, a nice player, but a guy that just cannot compete with the Cespedeses and Uptons of the world and Chris Davis and Jason Hayward and all the other guys that there were. And I thought he would have been really well served to take $16 million and come back and try again next year. He obviously didn't do that, and now he's in a precarious situation where I think he's either going to take less money for 1 year, maybe $10 or $12 million, or he's going to take a two-year deal that's maybe, I don't know, $25, $26 million. I think he's in a tough spot here. But as far as him coming back to the Cubs, I don't see that at all. Dexter Fowler is not a reason to trade Jorge Soler. I advocate possibly moving Soler for pitching, but you're not going to do it because Dexter Fowler is a free agent. But I think he's in a tough spot.
Yeah, I think that the only scenario that I see them bringing Dexter back would be if they decided to do a monster four-man outfield, because you could do...
Is this a Japanese thing?
I'm not talking about bringing Merton in, too.
Oh, no.
I'm talking, like, you know, you've got four outfielders. Schwarber struggles against lefties, or at least did last year. I mean, he can always improve on that. But you have Soler, who, you know, may not be out there every single day, and then also has the injury issues. You have Schwarber, who can also maybe even take one game a week behind the plate. I think if they wanted to get really, really, really creative, they could really do well getting, even with everybody healthy, getting all those guys regular at-bats. And that would be really worth something looking into, because then you solve that extra man on the bench problem where you're debating Tommy La Stella or Matt Caesar. Now you have a guy who legitimately can play center field. Other than Jason Hayward, and then you can start, you know, Hayward and Wright when Soler's not out there, and, you know, on and on and on. But that's the only scenario where I could see them bringing him back, and it would require him basically, you know, showing up with his hat in his hand saying, I want to take a one-year deal for, you know, $10 to $12 million, and then check free agency again next year. But on the flip side of it, you know, we can argue that he probably should have done that, but early in free agency, it looked like Jeff Samardzija should have done that too. that he should have just taken a one-year deal and then gone back out there next offseason, and then he got a huge contract from the Giants. So it worked out for him.
That, yeah, I mean, I guess the difference is that was mid-December and this is mid-February.
True, but I'm talking about hindsight.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the one thing about Fowler, though, too, is we're already without our top two picks, and if we don't recover a pick from Fowler's free agency, then it's going to get pretty ugly. We won't pick until the actual third round rather than just losing our compensatory pick. So I think that has to be factored in as well. Oh, yeah, you're right. I'm gonna get blasted for saying we.
Yeah, you got a case of the wheeze.
Did you get hired by the team? That's awesome.
Yeah, I have another job I should tell you about, guys. Sorry.
I'm assistant GM. Assistant impaler to Tyler Colvin.
I quit. No, but I think it's something else to consider is that, yeah, maybe you go sign him for 1 year, but there's still a pick tied to him, and that pick has a direct relation to the value that he brings for us. So something to keep in mind.
Yeah, but still, I mean, the Cubs are at a point this year where if you were signing him and not dumping somebody off the roster who's like Soler, if you were signing him just to have him the value of Dexter Fowler over the last man on the bench and doing the kind of four-man monster rotation in the outfield, you wouldn't really care about losing the draft pick at that point, I don't think. You think at that point it's all about just going for it.
Kind of related here, let me ask you this. Do you guys see Jorge Soler on the team at the end of the year?
Probably on the DL.
Oh, come on.
Ouch.
Wah, wah.
Dang.
Sorry, everyone.
Yeah, I think he'll be on there.
I mean, you saw what he could do toward the end of the season, and then especially in the playoffs, and he's got just such monster potential, but it just makes so much sense to, if you can put someone in center.
If Almora is killing it at AAA and they just need to find a place to put him, then I can see that scenario happening. You move Hayward back into right, and then you get yourself a young pitcher. I can see that happening.
Yeah.
Don't tease me, Carlos. Don't do that to me.
But, no, we can I mean, all just, go watch
it,
this.
It guy. Makes so much sense, you know. I mean, because you could, if he puts it together, and I think he will. Just, I mean, maybe I'm just basing it alone on that game where he had two homers against the Cardinals, and the second one was just a rocket. But I would think you could get a lot for him, and that's, you know, that gets back to the fact that the dearth of pitching and on the BP 101 for the Cubs, and it's like, well, maybe they develop other position players and then trade for pitching, and Soler just makes perfect sense for that.
Yeah, and you know what? I like the strategy of you know, a lot of injuries. Pitchers go through a lot of injuries. It's harder to project them.
Yeah.
So to just say, you know, we're going to stockpile all these position players, and when we need pitching, we will either go to the free agent market and see what's available or trade for it. It's like, you're basically getting other teams to develop your pitchers for you without the risk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that this is throwing out a hypothetical that everybody's going to hate, but the Cubs are kind of going for it in this small window here. And I mean that in that they're set up for long-term success too, but they've got guys like Zobrist and Lackey and Jason Hamill. A lot of this is all set up for 2016 and 2017 and then kind of a retool after that. But if, let's say, Jake Arrieta gets hurt and is out for a significant amount of time.
We're done. Call it.
Yeah, sorry. But you've got guys you could trade for a stud starting pitcher mid-season this year. The 2016 Cole Hamels sweepstakes, whoever that is. You could trade from a position of depth with your farm system or Jorge Soler if you are bringing up Almora and, you know, retool on the fly and do just fine going into the playoffs if you can get, you know, a stud starting pitcher for a few prospects.
I wonder if you can fool people with Vogelbach.
Nope.
No.
You don't think so? You think the secret's out? No.
The joke that I always throw out is, for trades, how many Vogelbachs would it take? So can we give you 6 Vogelbachs for this guy? Because that's kind of how fans have been doing it for a long time is, you know, let's give them a decent player and then fool them with Vogelbach and then we'll trade, you know, those guys for, you know, Cole Hamels.
Yeah.
I think it's a tough argument on Soler, though, because in a lot of ways, the only way he's going to have the value to bring back something that you want in return is if he's doing what he did in the playoffs. And at that point, it becomes so hard to trade him because he's doing it in front of the Wrigley faithful and everybody's fallen in love with him. And, you know he's just has an infectious smile and everything else. I think it's going to be really hard to trade him if he does what he's capable of doing. On the flip side, if he doesn't do that, his value plummets. He's not a good defensive player. He's not a great base runner. So you're not going to get much for him. I think the ship kind of sailed on trading Soler. I was in the camp of saying, yeah, move him for pitching. But I feel like there's two divergent paths here, and neither one of them ends up with him being traded. But I could definitely be wrong.
I guess it just kind of depends on how well he's performing. I mean, if you're talking about he's going to be the player he was in the playoffs against St. Louis where he gets on base nine consecutive times, mm-hmm. Then yeah, you're not trading that guy. But mid-season, if the guy's batting, just throwing out slash lines, .275 and a .340 on base and a .470 slugging and has hit 7 home runs, 8 home runs in July, I mean, that guy is still putting up decent numbers, but as far as from the Cubs standpoint, possibly replaceable if you can deal him for, I don't know, just throwing out a name, Sonny Gray.
Yeah, well, I mean, his defense really, I mean, I didn't think he was great defensively, but he was pretty bad at times, which was pretty disappointing. But, you know, then if you do move him, let's just, based on whatever scenario, if you do move him, then that leaves a hole in center. And what are you going to do then? Is Almora, you know, we've talked about, Carlos has talked about Javi Baez and how legitimate is he as a center fielder? And, you know, and Ryan, you were talking about how the window isn't, you know, huge, this wide gap here. Well, do you want to bring up a rookie, Almora? I know they say he's got poise, but if the window is not that wide, can you put a rookie in center field and be a World Series team?
I completely agree with that thesis, Joel. I mean, I think that what they've done is split the windows into two. There's the first window, which is Lackey and Zobrist and Arrieta, most likely, along with the young core. And then the second window starts in 2018 with the free agent class that will be available then. So I think you're right. I think they've placed their cards into what they've got for the guys that are on the team now for the next 2 or 3 years. And I don't see them really jeopardizing that by bringing a rookie up mid-year to be in a starting role, even if Almora is killing it. I think you're exactly right.
Well, I also think that, I completely agree on that with the kind of two split window. If you're going to do a trade like that, it's probably going to be because you think the offense is just killing it and it's good enough that if you were to trade away Soler to move Hayward into right field and put Almora in center, it's because you're probably batting Almora ninth and you're counting on him giving you absolutely nothing on offense. And you're doing it simply to improve as much as you are defensively and with whatever Soler brings back as far as pitching.
Well, it's interesting. We talked about kind of that window and, you know, what might happen after Hamill and Lackey are gone. There's two spots that you need to fill in for the rotation. I want to change gears and look at the catching situation for a bit. Seems like we've been talking about catching a lot on BP Wrigleyville. I counted about four pieces within the past week, especially some of the new catching metrics. And I know Isaac has some interesting opinions on these new metrics, which I want to get to. But so we've got three catchers on the team, right? Let's just count Schwarber as a catcher, even though he's going to spend the bulk of his time in left. David Ross is retiring at the end of this year, so there goes your backup catcher. Montero, I think, is signed through two more years. Is that right?
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I was looking at today, and I felt like a conspiracy nut as I was thinking about it, because who was their plan A before they signed Montero?
Was it Russell Martin.
Russell Martin. And if you look at Russell Martin under these new catching stats at Baseball Prospectus, he is phenomenal. I mean, he is out of this world. There's nobody better than him since 2006 for all these stats combined. It's crazy, right? So they obviously value framing. They value these numbers. Framing is the bulk of that, you know, catching defense rating. They went after him. They couldn't get him. Then they went with Montero, who, I mean, let's be honest, he's a fantastic framer. But Wilson Contreras is a below average framer. Do we really think that here's what I'm getting at. Next year is a big season for him. If he can't show that he's headed in the right direction in improving his framing, he's going to get traded, and they're just going to go for somebody else.
Oh, that makes like the deepest part of my soul hurt. I think he's going to be a plus hitter for average. He's going to get on base. I think he'll develop more power than he currently has. I highly doubt that this front office will actually let, especially the metrics of minor league stats, dictate whether or not they trade Wilson Contreras. I think he brings so much to the table that framing statistics in the infancy of what they are cannot capture.
And who was it that you said he reminded you of?
Just the way he moves defensively, he reminds me a little bit of Wellington Castillo.
Oh, okay.
Interesting, because obviously they were down on Castillo enough to bring in Montero and Ross while Castillo was still on the roster. So there might be something there to the idea that that if he doesn't improve enough, they may move him. But I also think that it's however much you read into it, but Montero had a lot of really great things to say about the improving Wilson Contreras, and Montero is still under contract for next year, and he's a really important player on this team, the way they're constructed and in this clubhouse. It wouldn't surprise me at all if they don't try and move him. They just honor what's left on his contract. And
yeah, I mean, the things he's been saying about how he's coming in and working with Kyle Schwarber is, I mean, it's the tweets that you were mentioning where he came out saying, oh, Contreras, he's the best, he's going to be one of the greatest. That combined with him taking Schwarber under his wing, kind of showing him the ropes. I like the guy. He's a good framer. He's got some pop in his bat. I like him on the team. And got, you know, we need to have some continuity. We can't just keep acquiring and bringing in new guys the whole time.
Yeah, and I think I should clarify when I say that he reminds me of Castillo. Really, he reminds me in his athleticism. Castillo was an excellent blocker, had a pretty solid arm. That's where he reminds me. I think Wilson Contreras is a much better hitter. I think he's got more time to develop as a framer, if you value that. But I don't necessarily suggest that we should go ahead and trade Montero or anything like that. Honestly, I think what's going to happen is Contreras and Montero are going to end up making one awesome platoon at some point here. Inevitably, as one of Montero or Ross misses some time, that's when I think we'll see Contreras on the big league roster.
Yeah, I agree with that. That's kind of where I was trying to go with it. is that I think eventually that's what you're going to see next year is you're going to see, you know, Ross gone and then Montero still around and then Contreras kind of splitting time with him at catcher with Miggy kind of acting in that mentor role.
And Isaac, I do want to hear from you on, you know, these newfangled metrics, right, that focus so much on framing and weight it so heavily. Really, when you look at how the metrics analyze framing, they really discount blocking and throwing. They value it much less than traditional scouting does. So, I'd like to hear your thoughts on framing the statistic. And, you know, this front office does seem to be weighing it very heavily.
Yeah, I think actually that this front office and maybe some other ones are actually using it as a bit of a smokescreen in some ways.
Not a conspiracy.
Oh, man.
I wouldn't go that far, but I think that they maybe talk about it more than they actually believe in it. I caught for a long time, and I was also an umpire for about 18 years. And the one thing I think that is sorely lacking in all of these metrics is actually understanding what an umpire sees, how he sees it when he sees the ball, how he understands the spin of the pitch, where it's coming across, where the batter's set up, where the catcher's set up, what his relationship with the pitcher is, which way the wind's moving, whether or not he had a good day or a bad day. You know, whether or not he hates the third base coach, whether or not he likes the manager. I'm just saying there are hundreds of things that go into an umpire's and out of his mind during a given game. And we've essentially boiled framing down to entirely what the catcher does, how he holds his glove, how he receives the pitch, how he moves his body, what position he's in. And I think that we're talking about one small data point in the equation and discounting many, many other things that actually have more to do with whether a given pitch is called a ball or a strike than essentially how the catcher received the pitch. I think we've way overrated it. We've way overstated how many runs can be saved by it. And what has happened is we've begun to underrate a catcher's ability to hit. We've begun to underrate a catcher's ability to control the running game, which is one metric that I saw in Catchella that I loved is how well they control the running game. I think that is a lot more important than many of the framing statistics. So it's actually something that I'm really still researching and trying to come to my own conclusion as to how much I want to value it. But I know for a fact that I will land on that we have way overvalued it as a sabermetric community.
Well, I think that, do you think that this current Cubs front office is maybe outsmarting itself a little bit? I mean, they're always looking to exploit the next market inefficiency. You know, Moneyball was all about on-base percentage, and we talked about maybe they're not developing pitchers. They're using other teams as their farm system for pitchers. Do you think that maybe they're kind of latching onto this as a market inefficiency but overvaluing it?
I don't think that. And I will say, going back to my Wilson Contreras comments, I think at the end of the day, a guy like that is still going to kind of carry the torch above a guy that maybe doesn't do anything else well but frames really well. I think that with your thesis, if they overvalued it, they would have overpaid Russell Martin, which they did not do. Everybody knew that he was kind of the sabermetric darling as far as framing goes, and they stayed pretty true to their valuation of Russell Martin and didn't overpay him, even though a lot of people talked about, you know, he would want to come to Chicago and come play here and everything else. But I think this front office is too savvy to really throw too many of their, you know, their hats into one ring like that. But I do think that they trumpet the metric maybe more than they actually believe in it. I couldn't tell you exactly why, but I think they talk about it more than maybe actually believe in it.
Yeah, and I agree with that. The other thing that I think is important to note that I think it's kind of lost in the whole thing is, you know, other than framing, what else do Montero and Russell Martin really have in common? And that's that they're both, I mean, upper echelon offensive catchers in the league too. Montero had two kind of down years right before he left the Diamondbacks and bounced back pretty well last year. As far as just as a hitter goes, he hits with decent power, he gets on base.
Yeah, you know, I was actually looking at their numbers today, and they're very similar. I think 270 and 271 true average on both of those guys. Very similar numbers.
Yeah, and so I think that they do value other things just other than framing. They didn't go out and just say, you know, let's go find some backup catcher or AAA catcher who's amazing at framing but can't hit the ball and bring him in, because that would have been kind of, you know, then we're talking about, are they overvaluing it as the next, you know, market inefficiency. But I think they were just targeting who's available, who matches kind of what we want, what we need. And I think both those guys fit that. So I do see a lot of what Isaac's saying about that they kind of trumpet that publicly as, you know, part of their value. But I don't know if it's necessarily the most important thing.
Yeah, we've also seen some articles begin to come out really questioning some of the ways that framing has been tallied and the runs associated with it, the runs saved associated with it. So I agree. I think that they're still looking at it holistically, and they're not just narrowing it down to this one area, to answer your question, Joel.
Yeah, and based on what you were saying earlier, we're talking about Contreras being such a great athlete. I mean, it seems like that's been Joe Maddon's philosophy, and you see the Cubs kind of working that way too. It's like you play Bryant at third, you play him in left, you play him in center, you play Baez at short, you play him at second, you play him in center. And so Contreras obviously stays a catcher, but if he's a good athlete, it's more the makeup rather than specific individual stats. So I think you're kind of seeing the holistic thing with him. Maybe that's one area that maybe he's lacking, but there's, you know, clearly that's something you can learn. And as you're saying, maybe the pendulum swings the other way and they realize, hey, we've kind of overvaluing this.
Yep, definitely could be. It definitely could be. And I just think that what he brings to the game is going to overcome anything that he may lack in that area. I don't think we even do know if we lack in that area. He hasn't been catching all that long. I think he can still learn along those lines, and that remains to be seen.
So let's leave the catching behind and move on to a statistic that you feel differently about, Isaac. So we're going to call the stat of the week. We're trying to kind of focus on a specific stat and take a deeper dive and kind of explain it away for the folks out there. What do you got today?
What I've got today for you is called base running runs. This is a metric that Baseball Prospectus measures. It's called BRR if you're looking for it. Essentially what base running runs does is try and tally how much a player affects the game with everything that he does once he's on base. So this doesn't have anything to do with getting on base or drawing walks, anything like that, but it's five different metrics that are compiled into one. They are hit advancement runs, ground advancement runs, error advancement runs, equivalent stolen base runs, and other advancement runs, which those are all pretty self-explanatory, but what I'd actually like to focus on tonight is a fairly shocking stat that I uncovered.
Shocking.
Yeah, seriously, it is. Okay. I'll give you all three guesses as to who led the Cubs in 2015 in base running runs. Three guesses.
Chris Bryant.
I was going to say Chris Bryant.
False. He was second.
Anthony Rizzo.
Nope, he was Anthony Rizzo was the eighth worst base runner in all of baseball.
I'd go with Addison Russell then, or Starlin Castro, one of those two.
Good guess, but wrong and wrong. By far, the best base runner on the Cubs was Kyle Schwarber.
Wow. Oh.
Yeah.
Trade him.
Yeah, right. He's built his value up as much as he can. Now, Kyle Schwarber rated around average, slightly above average in everything but the stolen base, equivalent stolen base metric, which he was somewhat below average. He had three steals and three caught stealing, but he was way above average in the hit advancement runs, tallying 2.87 runs in that specific metric. That 2.87 left him seventh in all of baseball.
Wow.
Listen to the names in front of Kyle Schwarber. Lorenzo Cain, Brett Gardner, Alcides Escobar, Adam Eaton, Jason Hayward, who, by the way, was the fourth best base runner in baseball, and Torrey Hunter. So six speedsters and then Kyle Schwarber.
Torii Hunter?
Torii Hunter.
Huh.
Torii Hunter, does he count as a speedster?
I guess I was wondering that.
Well, he's an athletic guy. Maybe not anymore, but at one time.
Did you see what he looked like last year?
I did, yes.
Still got the magic, apparently.
That's really interesting. I love hearing statistics that just kind of surprise you and show you something new.
Well, and I think it was 28 out of 29 times, don't quote me on that, but that's close, 28 out of 29 times Kyle Schwarber was able to take the extra base, whether it be a single from first to third, a single from second to home, or a first to home on a double, which is, those are the three metrics that hit advancement runs actually measures. And so essentially what it's telling you is that he had great secondary leads. He read the ball off the bat very well, and he wasn't afraid to aggressively run the bases and do it with a lot of confidence and successfully. So I just think it's an area of his game that maybe nobody had realized, including myself until this week, that he was possibly elite at, something to follow.
Question out of my own ignorance towards the stat. How much does it involve or include who bats behind or in front of the player? Because if Schwarber has just thrown out a player from last year, Starlin Castro batting behind him all year or his entire time there, you get a lot of ground balls. Probably not a lot of first to third going on with Castro batting behind you. So how much does that factor in?
I think it could be a factor in that, but it's also based on, and it's not based on strictly whether or not you went. It's based on whether or not you were expected to take it, and so that's factored into the equation, is whether or not you were expected to get there. So essentially, in situations where he was expected to do something, he went above and beyond and all but one time was successful in achieving that. So I don't think that it plays into it based on maybe the hit tendencies of the player behind you, but I think that could use a little bit more research. And this is actually what I'm writing my piece on for Wrigleyville this week, is Schwarber's base running tendencies. These are the things you write about in February, right?
But Ryan, you didn't get the email about not attacking the stat of the week, but you're in your inbox for future episodes.
Yeah, sorry.
No, I
was just going to ask questions. Just asking questions.
No questions. Just believe everything we say.
Yes, take it on faith.
No, I definitely think that's good, but I don't believe that's tallied in, because this is actually something that's equated after the fact, and they just gauge it whether or not you were expected to advance or not.
It's funny that Ryan and I both thought of Chris Bryant, because he was obviously, his hit tool was amazing, but he on the base.
You're talking about Chris Bryant.
Yes. Okay. I'm not talking about Ryan on the base.
Okay, just checking.
I'm pretty speedy.
I don't doubt that you're a speedster, Ryan.
I'm a good Kyle Schwarber comp for my running. You would not expect me to be as fast as I am.
But Bryant really has some wheels, which surprised me. I mean, I remember seeing him go from second to home several times or first to third, and just it surprised me for a guy his height how fast he was.
Yeah, Bryant was second on the list for the Cubs, and it actually really surprised me. There were several things that surprised me, but he was about a run behind Schwarber on the list, so that was something I expected. But then, Carlos, I think you answered Anthony Rizzo. The fact that he came in the bottom handful of players in the majors really surprised me. So I think we see this year whether or not that's true with Rizzo, see if the stats advance or not, but he ranked horribly in that metric.
That is surprising. For some reason. All right, so let's see. Should we move on to Ryan's, what do we got, 60 seconds with a former Cub?
Yeah, just real quick, this was kind of Joel's idea.
Is that what we called it?
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah.
Make sure I got that right, okay.
Yeah, Joel, do you kind of want to explain the segment, explain the bit, what it is, since it was your brilliant idea?
Sure.
It's got to be in 60 seconds too, though.
Okay, it'll be shorter than that. Basically, I wanted to just kind of take a look back at former Cubs, and they can be Cubs that we all really liked, Hisop Choi is the first name that came to mind, or kind of, we all liked him, come on, don't laugh, you liked him, you liked that big looping lefty swing.
Wait, we had to like our players? I picked one out.
Or just players that you kind of remembered for whatever reason, and they can be stars, or they can be kind of also-rans, or players who were kind of campy, like a Steve Swisher, who was an all-star. So just to kind of look back and just walk a quick stroll down memory lane and update on certain players and what maybe their most shining moment as a Cub and what they did after leaving the Cubs, and go as most recent as we can to what they're up to now.
Cool. Well, based on our kind of pre-podcast talk about Matt Merton, I decided that the guy I wanted to pick for this week was Eric Patterson, involved in that trade, of course, for Rich Harden, along with some other guy named Josh Donaldson and Sean Gallagher. Sean Gallagher, I also was thinking about doing taking him as well. But Eric Patterson, obviously, most Cub fans know, the younger brother of Corey Patterson, was with the Cubs while Corey Patterson was still there. And I remember the first time I got any kind of impression of Eric Patterson was, I want to say 2005 or 2004. They played like a right at the beginning of spring training, kind of an inner squad game where the major leaguers play the minor leaguers, and Eric Patterson had a day. He had like a bases clearing triple or something like that. And I just remember getting excited about him, even though he was a total non-prospect. And so Eric Patterson made it up to the Cubs in August of 2007 when Soriano had to go on the DL, and it got his first major league hit off Woody Williams, a single to left field against the Houston Astros. The most notable thing about Eric Patterson's career with the Cubs, I already kind of mentioned, was he was a piece in the Rich Harden deal. His best season came in 2009 with the A's. He only played 38 games, but slashed .287, .373 on base, and a .394 slug. He was traded by the Reds, by the A's to the Red Sox in 2010 for a minor leaguer. And then something that I didn't realize about Eric Patterson, he was traded again that offseason to the Padres for Adrian Gonzalez. Who knows who else was in that trade?
Anthony Rizzo.
Yeah, he was traded with Anthony Rizzo to the Padres.
Yep.
So also affected future Cubness with that. He played 1 year with the Padres and was released, signed with the Tigers, the Brewers, and White Sox at various times, and never played in the major leagues with any of them, and has been with the York Revolution in independent ball since 2014. Hit 15 home runs and 17 triples with a .913 OPS in 2014, but dropped off pretty bad last year with a .741 OPS, Isaac's favorite stat, at age 32. And if I could sum up in one little phrase why I don't think he probably made it as a major leaguer, it's
his last name is Patterson.
That kind of leads into it. He struck out 29.1% of the time.
Yeah.
Ouch. Yeah. So
I was looking up Corey's stats here.
Don't do it, Joel.
He played for 11 years, and in 2003. He was having a really good year before he blew out his knee on first base. He had
298, 13, 14 home runs. I remember
numbers. 55 RBIs, OPS of .839, 16 stolen bases. That was, of course, he was center field, so then they traded for Kenny Lofton, not James Lofton.
James
probably
Lofton.
Better hands. But that was actually a pretty big loss, because that year he looked like he was really starting to put it together. But he was probably the most frustrating player. After that, he just he drove me absolutely bananas.
I think he got kind of a raw deal. He had a pretty good 2004. It wasn't anywhere near as good as 2003, but he was still a pretty good player. It wasn't until 2005. Yeah, it wasn't until 2005 that he really dropped off.
Well, and his power was really sapped by the injury, wasn't it? I mean, wasn't that the big thing? He just never looked the same power-wise.
Well, he had 24 homers in 2004,
yeah.
Which is respectable, but he also struck out 168 times in 157 games.
Yeah, you just can't do that.
If we want to bring it full circle and say, a player who had the potential to be an every year all-star in center field that the Cubs minor league system and coaching just completely failed, it's Corey Patterson. They rushed him to the major leagues. I didn't realize that they drafted him, what, in 1999 or 98? And they had him called up into the major leagues in 2000.
Yeah.
Wow.
For a very brief, short amount of time. I mean, they rushed him.
The major league team was so bad that I remember there was, like, a lot of pressure from fans. Like, show us something. What are you doing right? And Corey Patterson was the jewel of the system that said, look, we at least have this coming.
Yeah.
It is pretty incredible if you go back and look at the decision-making processes that went into those teams that weren't competitive. And, you know, they're rushing decent, not great, but decent prospects onto the team to basically satisfy the fans. And then you look at it today, and the front office cares so little about what the outside perspective thinks that they're not even willing to bring up Chris Bryant to sacrifice the year of, you know, the year of control. It's just fundamentally a paradigm shift in the way the office thinks.
Yeah.
Well, guys, this is the first episode of many of what I really am excited about this Cubs season coming up. So I'm pumped to do this every week with you guys. The first one is wrapped up. Anything you guys want to add before we call it a night?
Nope.
I'm good.
All good. It's time for bed, I think.
All right. Email listeners. You can email us at bpwrigleycast@gmail.com with suggestions, comments, hateful email. We'll read it all.
Yes, send all of your hateful comments.
All right.
Take care.
All right, thanks.